herzlich willkommen zu meinem Sonderpodcast featured bei Handelsblatt. Es geht heute um Liquidität und den Einfluss auf die Kapitalmärkte. Das Interview mit Dr. Michael Howell ist auf Englisch. Die Untertitel findet ihr bei mir auf YouTube. Wir sind bei der Foundation for the Study of Cycles, einer Zyklenkonferenz in New York. Viele Anleger schauen an der Börse vor allen Dingen auf Ertragswachstum, wie entwickeln sich die Gewinne der Unternehmen, auf die amerikanische Notenbank, was macht die Zinspolitik. Michael Howell, ehemals Salomon Brothers und Baring, Gründer und CEO von Cross Border Capital, er sagt, der wahre Taktgeber an den Kapitalmärkten ist eigentlich die globale Liquidität. Wo stehen wir also im Liquiditätszyklus und was bedeutet das für die Kapitalmärkte im Jahr 2026? Viel Spaß beim Gespräch.
Welcome, Michael Howell. Thanks for taking the time with us today for having this short talk about the global liquidities. In today's world, this global liquidity plays a more important role these days than fundamentals and the traditional measures or metrics we are mainly looking at. So how do you think global liquidity changes that importance of fundamentals?
Yeah. Well, I think that's an excellent question, Lars. I think the point is that, you know, we're schooled in the idea that markets will react to fundamentals, but actually capital gets there first. The money flow is there initially, and fundamentals tend to respond to that. So I'm not saying that fundamentals are unimportant in looking at markets, but they're, if you like, a lagging indicator. They're the justification for why people are buying stocks. So you raise a very good point as to say, why is this perhaps more important than historically? And the reason being is this: think of the size of the financial markets relative to GDP. So in the US now, the financial markets are at least 2 times GDP. But if you go back 30, 40 years, they were a much lower percentage, maybe about 50, 60% of GDP. So the financialization of the economy, in other words, the big growth of financial markets and the importance of wealth effects, is now why this is so important in terms of what happens. I mean, you could argue the tail is wagging the dog, but nonetheless, that's the reality we live in.
In practical terms, how would investors use global liquidity and what indicator would they actually look at?
What I would say is you look at the mechanism of how that money is moving through markets. So look for signals. You can look at what the Federal Reserve balance sheet, for example, is doing, or you could look specifically at what's happening to bank reserves in the US. You could look at similar metrics in China or in Japan or even in the European Union. You could think about how bank reserves, bank liquidity is changing there. You could look at things like the volatility of the bond markets. These are critical elements in the movement of liquidity.
Lars shared with me during the beginning of the Iran war some of your global liquidity analysis. And the analysis looked actually quite bearish for the markets. Did your global liquidity indicators signal this, or what changed actually?
I think the thing to do is to put this in context. And I think, like any form of cyclical analysis, you've got to try and look at companion cycles, and you've got to try and understand context. And what I'm really arguing is that if you look at the characteristics of markets, they're displaying late cycle characteristics, okay? Now, that's an important input in itself, okay? It's very difficult to use cycle analysis per se to predict with precision a particular movement. So to say this is the top or this is the bottom of a market is hard. What you can say is what kind of regime you're in. Are you in a bottoming out period? Are you in a strong uptrend in the cycle? Are you around the peak? Now, we think you were around the peak of the liquidity cycle. That doesn't mean to say that you're going to get a collapse tomorrow, but it means that you should be looking for those late cycle signs. And we identify this phase as being what we call speculation. In speculation, what happens is you can get decent returns, but they coexist with high volatility. So the quality of those returns is actually reduced significantly. And that's the phase that we think we're in. The other thing to think about is what's happening in the bond markets, because the bond markets are also critical to this. And in fact, the bond markets are often more important because they're the part of the funding mechanism. Now, if you look at the bond markets, what you're getting is a movement in the term structure, which is called a bearish flattening of the curve, which means that the long end of the curve yields are going up, but they're going up at a slower pace than the front end. So the curve is basically beginning to flatten and invert. And that's a very late cycle signal normally, and it's not a good omen either.
So looking forward, when the late cycle process is in a peaking process, what happens next usually? What would you be looking for as an investor?
Well, the next phase is basically to say what then begins to happen is that bonds start to come into their own as a better asset class. Now, you begin with shorter duration debt, and then you move mid-duration and then finally longer duration. So this should be a phase as liquidity falls lower, that the bond market should be getting more of a bid. Now, it's difficult to see that at the moment, clearly, because there's a lot of negativity about bonds. But in a way, that's telling you that we're moving towards the end of that particular phase. When everyone sort of believes that the story is negative, it normally flips to being positive.
So how did you came up with that cyclic identification? So, I mean, you did it in the year of 2000, so it's a long time ago.
Yeah. So. Well, I think, the first thing to say is that we'd identified cycles in the data before, okay? In terms of actually measuring it, we saw there was clear evidence of cycles. We were beginning to see from the data, because of the length of data we had, that there was a regular pattern. So we tried to fit that using Fourier analysis, and we did that quite thoroughly in about year 2000. Now, what we've done since then is, after establishing what we then found was a 65-month cycle, is then to extrapolate that forwards in time, which we've done over the last 25 years, and then to look at the actual outcomes relative to that predicted template. And it seems to line up reasonably well.
We have a new head of the Federal Reserve, Kevin Warsh. He mentioned the idea of lowering the balance sheet in the United States and backpedaled quite a bit. What's your take? What do you want to see from him in this new role he's taking?
Well, I think that's a leading question and a difficult question to answer. But I would say that, the first thing to say is that is the Federal Reserve the real mover and shaker still in the markets? I mean, that's really the question. Or what particular lever is it that's important for the Federal Reserve? Now, everyone focuses, because we're clearly told to focus on this by the media in particular and by the Fed, is the Fed funds rate. Now, there's a whole pantomime around setting Fed funds rate, the FOMC meeting, the presser. I mean, you understand all this. It's really a pantomime. For example, in the last 5 to 6 months, the Federal Reserve has injected $600 billion into U.S. money markets. I mean, that's a sizable amount of cash, almost a trillion we're talking about, has gone into the markets. Any wonder why Wall Street is bubbling, okay? Now, what they've done is to do that because the repo markets were getting thirsty, or they're running out of liquidity, and you were starting to see spikes in the rate I mentioned, the SOFR rate. The other thing you've got to look at is, let's broaden this out from the Federal Reserve, let's think about what the Treasury is doing. The Treasury is, first of all, skewing issuance in the U.S. towards the front end of the maturity structure of government debt. So they're issuing lots of T-bills, not issuing longer-dated 30-year debt, for example. And who buys that debt are the banks. Okay, so if banks buy government debt and buy Treasury bills with alacrity, what does that mean? That's called monetization. That's called printing money. Because if a bank, an intermediary, buys government debt, they're monetizing the debt. So that's clearly printing money, and something that the old monetarist, late monetarist Milton Friedman, will be turning in his grave at looking at what the Federal Reserve is doing.
But that it doesn't look like it's going to change.
No, it's going to get worse.
Werbung.
Die Börse liebt Schlagzeilen. Ne? Heute KI-Euphorie, morgen Rezessionsangst, übermorgen Zinshoffnung. Aber genau in solchen Phasen zeigt sich, wer wirklich einen klaren Investmentprozess hat und wer einfach nur dem Markt hinterherläuft. Ein Ansatz, den ich seit Jahren spannend finde, ist der von DJE Kapital und dem FMM-Fonds. Der Fonds wurde bereits 1987 aufgelegt, mitten in einer Börsenkrise, und gehört damit zu den traditionsreichsten unabhängigen Fonds Deutschlands. Das Besondere daran, hier orientiert man sich eben nicht starr an irgendeinem Index. Der FMM-Fonds setzt bewusst auf aktives Management und auf klare Überzeugungen. Investiert wird überwiegend in Aktien, ergänzt durch Anleihen oder auch Edelmetalle wie Gold oder Silber, wenn das Marktumfeld es sinnvoll erscheinen lässt. Well, die Grundlage aller Investmententscheidungen ist die sogenannte FMM-Methode. F steht für fundamental, also die Analyse von Unternehmen, Branchen und Volkswirtschaften. Das erste M steht für monetär, Zinsen, Inflation, Liquidität und Geldmengen. Und das zweite M steht für markttechnisch, also Marktstimmung, Trends und Momentum. Und genau diese Kombination macht den Ansatz so interessant. Denn Ziel ist nicht kurzfristige Spekulation, sondern Risiken frühzeitig erkennen, Marktschwankungen abfedern und Kapital möglichst langfristig erhalten. Hinzu kommt ein sehr aktiver Share. Das Portfolio bildet also keinen Index einfach nach, sondern setzt auf eine bewusste Auswahl einzelner Unternehmen, aktuell unter anderem mit einem starken Fokus auf Europa. Wenn du also mehr über den FMM-Fonds und den Investmentansatz von DJE Kapital erfahren möchtest, findest du alle Infos auf dje.de/fmm.
Now, what is your take on the long bond deal for this year? And maybe in regards to your statement that 2026 specifically is an important year, also in regards to debt that needs to be refinanced.
Well, I think the first thing to say is that the data and my impressions are that the US economy is booming. There's no question about that. Okay, it may be a K-shaped economy, as people say, but the fact is, on average, the economy is booming. Inflation is becoming a problem. Okay, there's no question about that. Whichever way you split that, you can say that nominal GDP growth, the sum of the two, real activity and inflation, are humming along at a fast pace. That figure may be 7%, it may be 8%, but it's that sort of magnitude. Is that consistent with a long bond of under 5% or circa 5%? It's not. Okay. There's got to be upward pressure on the bond market. So what are the authorities doing? They're trying to cap bond yields by swinging issuance towards the short end, starving the long end of issuance, okay? So there's excess demand for long-dated bonds, keeping yields down. And they're managing volatility to encourage more buying by hedge funds who are doing an arbitrage called a basis trade. I mean, this is getting into the weeds of bond market talk, but basically they're doing a basis trade where they're buying cash bonds and they're shorting futures, but that depends on low volatility. So what's happening alongside is the Treasury is coming into the market and suppressing volatility. So it's not yield curve control, it's yield volatility control that's going on. And they're doing that through Treasury buybacks. So every time there's a move up in the what's called the move index, which is the index of bond volatility, like the VIX, but for bonds, every time that index moves higher, Treasury buybacks increase and volatility comes down again. So there's direct intervention. So my view is that far more important than Fed funds is the move index.
Absolutely. And you saw that during the beginning of the Iran war, right? I mean, the move index went parabolic, but also turned down.
And they hammered it down.
And they turned down and helped Wall Street rally once
Correct.
Again.
Lars.
Talking about markets also a little bit, you monitor the gold to oil ratio as another measurement of markets. So can you tell us how is this related to global liquidity and what do you see in the gold to oil ratio?
The gold oil ratio has been fixed at 20. Therefore, you should be getting this high or ultimate moving gold. Doesn't mean to say that if the Iran tensions subside, gold won't fall back short term. It will be. We're talking about the longer term. Now, then if you start to think about these cycles and why this is important in a cyclical context, it so happens that if you track the gold-oil ratio, it also moves in this same 65-month cycle, exactly the same as the global liquidity cycle. And if you look at the beginning of the upswing of the gold-oil ratio, it moves because the gold price goes up, not because the oil price falls. Okay, so at the front end of the cycle, more liquidity expansion raises gold prices. At the back end of the cycle, what happens is the gold price doesn't come down. It's much more the oil price goes up, and that's what forces the ratio down. Now, why is that happening at the end of the liquidity cycle? Because the end of the liquidity cycle occurs because money leaves financial markets and moves into the real economy. And we are monitoring through this cycle money flow through financial markets.
So the last global liquidity peak was in 2021. You see it peaking now in 2026. And you have a huge wave of IPOs hitting Wall Street. Right. Anthropic is coming. OpenAI is coming. How does that play into the liquidity cycle? And what effects do you think this will have?
Well, on the face of it, it plays poorly because it would suggest that money is being taken out of markets. And clearly, if you're taking out of money out of markets to fund activities in the real economy, which supposedly SpaceX is, although it may be the Mars real economy, who knows, but whatever it means, money is coming out of financial markets. And that is clearly a negative. I think the rider to that would be to say that what is the free float that they're actually going to put into the market? The free float is very small, okay, relative to the size of the IPO. So in actual fact, it would be very difficult, particularly for index funds, to get into this issue. And so there's a technicality, which may mean that this is a very successful IPO, simply because it's being so rationed. And in other words, if you're an index fund, you have to have a full market weighting or a much higher market weighting than you can ever get your hands on.
How does this refer to the asset allocation? So if we are now watching this global liquidity, I mean, you cannot invest in global liquidity.
Yeah, I mean, there's the liquidity tends to lead. But the way that we look at it is that we basically divide the liquidity cycle into phases. So we have four phases, which we generically call rebound, calm, speculation, turbulence. And the names give it away in a way. And what we tend to show is which asset class is good for each particular phase. And there's a transition, and it's not a binary transition. So you need to sort of to gradually move in and move out of different asset classes. But generally speaking, in the rebound or the upswing phases of the cycle, what you want are equities. Equities do best by far away. Okay, around the peak of the cycle, you want to be commodity-based. So have much bigger weightings than commodities. Why? Because the liquidity cycle leads the economy. And as you're peaking in liquidity, you're beginning to move from the trough to the acceleration stage in economies. And they demand more commodities. So that's the reason for that. And then as liquidity starts to tighten in financial markets, the cycle goes down, you want more defensive assets. And that probably means more cash, more shorter duration debt. Okay. And then as the squeeze gets bigger and bigger, you get towards the bottom of the cycle, then that's starting to weigh on the economy. The economy is beginning to slow. Investors want longer dated bonds, because you want duration in that environment, because it's likely that the central banks will then be cutting interest rates, and so bond markets will perform. And then we restart.
But how long can this run, and how high can it go?
Well, I mean, the answer, it's a question about risk management, not a question about precision of where do you predict the peak to be. In a phase where you've got a lot of speculation, you can devote some of your portfolio to speculation, okay, and good luck on that. So, you know, a lot of people are far, far better traders than me. So by all means, put 20% or whatever you feel comfortable with in speculative positions and go for it. That's right. You know, if you can act like a hedge fund and just ride momentum, fine. But you don't want to do that with the core of your portfolio. The core of your portfolio has got to be more disciplined in terms of its management. And it may be a more staid or boring part of the portfolio, but it's the one that people are going to fall back and depend upon. And, you know, if you're only getting, you know, 5 to 10% returns a year out of that core, that's okay, because that's going to probably beat inflation in the longer term, which is what you want.
I think that's actually one of the biggest mistakes retail investors make, right? That you basically become momentum players, right? A fascinating time.
Yeah, Michael, thank you for taking the time.
Great
pleasure. If someone wants to follow Global Liquidity and your work, what would you recommend? Where can we?
Probably the most straightforward way is Substack, and it's called Capital Wars.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you for coming.
General, thank you.
Und jetzt der obligatorische und BaFin-sichere Risikohinweis von Mr. Markus Koch.
Meine Damen und Herren, liebe Aufsichtsbehörden, ich darf Sie darauf hinweisen, dass die Inhalte in diesem Video ausschließlich der allgemeinen Information dienen und keiner Empfehlungen zum Erwerb oder der Veräußerung bestimmter Finanzinstrumente und somit keine Anlageberatung darstellen. Insbesondere können Wall Street Correspondents und der Vortragende nicht einschätzen, inwiefern die im Video gemachten Empfehlungen ihren Anlagezielen, ihrer Risikobereitschaft und Verlusttragfähigkeit entsprechen. Wer also auf Basis von Informationen in diesem Video etwaige Anlageentscheidungen trifft, trifft diese ausschließlich auf eigene Verantwortung und eigene Gefahr. Und das wiederum bedeutet, dass weder Wall Street Correspondent noch der Vortragende, das ist immer noch dieser Mann hier, für Verluste haften, die sie dadurch erleiden, dass sie Anlageentscheidungen aufgrund von Informationen oder Kommentaren in diesem Video getroffen haben. Vielen Dank für die Aufmerksamkeit und weiterhin einen erfolgreichen Handelstag. Quack.